Hello and welcome to the Guardian Books Podcast. I'm Richard Lee. This week we bring you Marilyn Robinson. Her first novel, Housekeeping, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in 1982, with her second, Gilead, going one better and taking the award in 2005. These novels, along with 2008's Home and 2014's Lila, have made her one of the world's most revered authors. But she's also a noted essayist. And her most recent collection, What Are We Doing Here?, takes her on an exhilarating tour through intellectual, religious, and academic history, from Calvin to Darwin, from Karl Marx to her own mother's indoctrination by Fox News. She came to London's Islington Assembly Hall to talk to Claire Armitstead, though we're sorry to say this recording suffers a little from the crackle of a live event. Claire began by asking about Robinson's decision to give her collection the questioning title, What Are We Doing Here?,
Well, I very often feel as if we don't give enough consideration to our absolutely exceptional condition, you know, as human beings who are capable of learning and thinking and in best cases making significant choices and so on. I think that we tend to forget what we're capable of and sort of drift off into various forms of trivialization. And I think it's a pity. People are amazing creatures. I think they're very much happier as they are more aware of how remarkable they actually are and the people around them. I'm not talking about, you know, exceptional individuals. I'm talking about human beings as, you know, as a species. So I'm in a way saying that, you know, looking at the highest periods of our civilization would help us to think how to live more consciously and fruitfully with more appreciation of what is possible and of what has been given to us. The humanities and education do this. They were understood as valuable in a humanizing way for a very long time, and I think now are under a kind of pressure that is irrational and impoverishing. And so, basically, that's a large part of my subject.
At one point, you group Freud, Marx, and Darwin as sort of three evil characters in a way.
I probably like Marx better than anybody I know. I mean, more than anybody I know likes Marx. But I don't want to think about evil characters. I think that the question is, how did they understand themselves in the first place, which is relative to what science was in 1849, you know, relative to what the state of the world was in 1850. You know, we forget how old these people are, you know, in the chronology of our civilization. Marx is contemporary with Lincoln. That's a very hard thing for people even to imagine, but Lincoln read Marx, you know, read his columns. I think that there are two things, really. One is that they are very much influenced by a point in history that was understanding evolution as a kind of a system for explaining relative conditions among races. And we know what that was about, you know. And then people have used them selectively ever since they were published, so that, you know, one of my great learning experiences in the earlier part of my life was finding out that Marxists knew nothing about Marx. They actually didn't read his books, you know? And if it was like you're dealing in a kind of impressionism if you say, well, actually, Marx didn't say that. You know, Marx was not on the side of the South in the Civil War. You can look it up, you can see what he said. This was considered a rather primitive approach to the exalted study of Marxism, you know? So nobody ever exists finally as a hero or a villain. Everyone is completely subject to the errors that they have living in the time and the culture where they live, and the use that is made of them, which is often a complete inversion of what they said in the first place.
And it's not just that trio, but you talk about the flawed historiography, that how bad history is, the history that is taught and that is regaled through generations. And you talk in the particular case of the US a lot, because as you say, that's where you're from. But it seems to me it is more widely applicable, always, what you say.
Yes, it's hard to know, you know, cultures have presentation selves, you know? I mean, things that they entirely believe about themselves. That, you know, a wanderer through the world that they have made for themselves would not find descriptive. It's just a human characteristic projected on the scale of a society, you know? And they cover up with special care and effectiveness, I think, the things that would be especially painful to look at, which is also perfectly human and understandable. But I don't think, I mean, I spent part of that long period that you're talking about reading history and reading literature that was associated with the history. And I had a PhD at that point, you know? And I felt as if I were reading about a world that I had not even dreamed of knowing, you know? One that was much more interconnected in all of its darkest ways and so on. One that it does not teach itself. One that foreigners, because they've usually come on vacation, are not particularly interested in hearing about. But there is that reality, there is that what we have hidden, and the very, all the suggestions that come with the fact that we tend to be rather desperate to hide it, you know? I don't think we'd know much, frankly.
And one of the areas of history that you've contested time and time again is the Reformation, mm-hmm. and particularly what you call Puritanism, but is to do with Calvinism or to do with Calvin, and the way that that's been completely misinterpreted to our great detriment.
Yes, well, I use Puritanism. I mean, Calvin had influence all over Europe and, you know, Africa and all sorts of places, but historically, I think that in the United States we associate Calvinism like with the Dutch, you know, with continental European history, and Puritanism is a strain of Calvinism that came through a specific history in Britain, associated with Cambridge, for example, which is where almost all of the early pastors in New England graduated, you know. They were a second generation of Calvinists. They had a history that modified their allegiance or their interpretation of Calvin. They really never called themselves Calvinists, very rarely did. They were called Puritans here polemically, and they just accepted the name, the way people accept polemical names. But they are different. They are different from Calvinists in general.
So what does it mean to you, that term, and why is it of such importance?
Well, there are a great many liberalizing, emancipating impulses in American culture that are very traceable to the British Puritans that came either in anticipation of the English Revolution or because they were escaping the consequences of the English Revolution. There was a theological and a social thinking of great density that developed in this culture that was rejected after the reinstitution of the monarchy, that went, as religious minorities tended to do, into a part of the new world where they could think their thoughts and worship as they chose. But if you look at the documents of the Cromwell Revolution and then you look at the documents of Jefferson and the American revolutionaries, clearly the thinking that came into crisis in England was carried into the new world and was very influential on the development of our culture. They were not repressive people. They were, by almost any informed account, the most liberal population on the earth at the time of their prominence in New England. And the fact that we have lost the narrative about innovations of ours, really, like freedom of the press, ban against cruel and unusual punishment, the generalization of public education through the culture without discriminating between boys and girls and so on, all that stuff comes from New England. If we had depended on Virginia and North Carolina, we would be a different culture altogether.
There are sort of always startling insights in these essays, and one of which was your thing about Russia. If Russia had not been involved in the Civil War, we would be in a much worse place now.
Yes,
so
exactly.
So talk about that a bit more. I thought that was fascinating.
Yes. You know, I always get the czars wrong. I always say Alexander because it sounds so czarish. but don't count on me, but it's a Nicholas, or, you know, you kind of know the range. But in any case, he did a very elegant thing. You know, he was, the abolition of serfdom had just been declared, and he saw Lincoln as being, you know, a brother spirit with him in this struggle against slavery. And the American Civil War was a huge economic crisis, especially for England and France, because slave labor produced the cotton that was manufactured in Lyon and overall, I mean, especially in Manchester. And so there was actually starvation in Manchester during the American Civil War because of the loss of the cotton trade, because the, you know, Lincoln barricaded the East Coast, in effect, so that the Southerners could not send their great cash crop into Europe. Anyway, so this was going on, and it was getting to a point where France and England decided it was insupportable, and they actually organized fleets to attack the United States and declare a peace, which would mean the South was left as a separate country to be the South, you know, with its slaves, with its cotton fields. So the Tsar of Russia decided that his fleets needed repair. So he sent the Russian fleets, one to Boston, New York, one to San Francisco. And so this huge navy, for which the United States had no equivalent, was just parked there. But the meaning of it was that the British and the French would not be allowed to intervene by sea, which would have been their method, so long as the war continued. So, I mean, it sounds so odd after all these years of stupid polemics, you know, and countries are, they all go their own way and they're all crazy in their own way and so on, but we should have said every morning during the Cold War that if it were not for Russia, we would not have won the Civil War. If it were not for Russia, we would not have abolished slavery. And then we should have lighted a candle or sent some flowers or something. And then we could get on with our quarrel about economics or whatever it was we thought we were arguing about. But I believe in the truth, you know, which is an odd thing to say. You shouldn't have to say it. But I keep finding things that are true in a way where you think people would have been much saner if they just knew this one little thing, you know?
And in that same line, you're pretty rude, in your own words, about Churchill, and particularly his 1946 speech, in which invoked, drew down, one might say, the Iron Curtain.
Yes, exactly. What Churchill does was, you know, it's a really quite an amazing speech, because one of the things that was true is that, of course, the Manhattan Project and any thought of using a bomb that the American public, of course, did not know existed because it was very, very secret, which means, I mean, within any country, the closest held secrets of the government are the ones that they don't want their own people to know, you know. So Nagasaki, Hiroshima, it terrified the American public because we had learned that simple lesson that whatever we can do, somebody else can do also. And so in the Iron Curtain speech, Churchill talks about who knows what silver wings bearing what apocalyptic weapons will be flying your way. You know what I mean? In 1946, this made a lot of sense to people, of course. I mean, that, you know, when you create the possibility of an event at that scale, you know that it's, if you've created something that's infinitely reversible and subject to variations. So he says basically that if we kept the British Empire going, then there would be places all over around the world that could encircle Russia. We could always park our fleets, you know. And so what he's saying, in fact, is that protect the empire and we will encircle Russia for you. This is in 1946. In 1946, there were, you know, people were still starving in Russia as a consequence of the war. They hadn't even begun to count their casualties. They'd lost big cities and so on. So it's absolutely, you know, creepy if you think it's inhumane in a very deep way to be threatening them in the absolutely immediate consequence of that war, where they lost more people, more everything else than anybody else could even reckon with, you know? I mean, that's just another one of those things where countries are crazy and crazy in their own ways, but they're also collections of human beings. And we ought to have a humane interest in the perspectives that other countries would be bringing to bear. And it's very disheartening. I mean, you know, I don't, you know, people have ideologies and that's whatever it is. But there is also the fact, I have lost my son. I have lost my limbs. I have, you know, the fires are not yet cool. We could have understood that, you know. And I think it's disgraceful that we would have proceeded to, in effect, threaten Russia before Russia had even caught its breath. I mean, we're having trouble with Russia now. They're badly on our nerves. And they're badly in our poll booths. But still, if there is anything to hang on to that gives you any hope of remaining sane through all this, I think it's learning truth that you had not considered before or had not had any exposure to before.
Now, some of these essays are written for the Academy, and mm-hmm. some of them are written in a religious context. Mm-hmm. And I just wondered how the three pillars of your life, not counting fiction, which we'll get onto, the politics, religion, and the Academy, sit together in your life.
Mm-hmm. It's true. I think that, I mean, I've had a very unusual experience, in fact, that I was teaching in what people call a secular university, you know? This word secular, it's just shorthand for, I don't know what they think, you know? But I was identified as the religious professor in my department. Not that this was true, it was just what people felt they knew about me. But I would sit in my office and the girl who was Hindu would come in and tell me, I hate the way people stereotype my religion, it's so, I knew you would understand, you know? And then the Buddhist would come in, you know? Then a couple of Jewish guys, you know? And the fact that I was religious, as they understood me, gave them much more hope of finding sympathy or understanding in me than if I had been a secular person that they spoke to in the same way, you know? And it made me very aware that religion is a much larger sort of harmonics that passes through culture than we are inclined to think. I mean, we could use religion to create mutual understanding if we were just able to deal with the fact that there is a huge sympathy among religions, you know, rather than using them as battle lines. We do so many things that seem unnecessarily crude and wrong. But I've learned over time to just set aside expectations that are associated with the word secular. People think what they think. Pretty interesting, you know. I've never encountered any difficulty in a university setting on the basis of my declared religious affiliations or anything else. I think that's one of the things that bothers me. People talk in these great generalizations. I encounter it all the time. Secular this and that. It does not at all square with my experience, and I just drop all those assumptions. Certainly I've never, in any way that I know, have been antagonized anyone simply by the fact of being straightforward about what I believe.
Make space this weekend. Space for films about Chilean romance, plays about millennial angst, and poetry that makes you want to write poetry. Those new jackfruit superfood samosas, or not. A writer that's never been written about. The manager you might love, and opinions you might not. It's your weekend. Make space to be inspired. Pick up The Guardian and The Observer this weekend.
Your politics go right the way back to an early non-fiction book about Sellafield. You chose to write about nuclear power and the damage it was doing. Mm-hmm. I'm really interested, how on earth did you come to that? That's not the terrain that we know you for now.
Right. Well, you know, I was very interested, for a long time I was very interested in ecological issues and so on. I grew up in what was almost a wilderness, would have satisfied most people's definitions of it, I think. So I was very struck by these continuous narratives of the impoverishment of nature and so on. But anyway, then I came to England. I taught at the University of Kent, and I read the newspapers. And one of the things that you find that's very startling, there, you know, there are very different conversations about these things in America and in England. And people would be shocked by information that clearly is not considered shocking information here. I was very struck by the indifference of the ecological communities of North America to information that they, for some reason, do not seek to propagate in the United States. You know, the fact is the globe is a closed system. Everybody's problem is everybody's problem. You know, we all live with the consequences of Chernobyl. So I wrote the book. It was partly that, you know, just trying to break through the sort of culture bubbles that make people not mutually communicating and not aware of the world as a global phenomenon.
The subtitle was interesting. It was the full title was Mother Country, Britain, the Welfare State and Nuclear Pollution. Would you give it the same subtitle now, or do you think that the agenda has changed?
Well, I will say, for one thing, that that title was given to it by its editor, who thought everybody would think it was a book of, you know, sentimental lyrics or something. I wish I could change the title. I never thought of a better one. That's an ugly title. That is an ugly title. And they put it on an ugly cover, you know.
Well, particularly...
And my sales figures were ugly. It was very...
I suppose it's the welfare state, in a way. Right?
Yeah.
Because that has been historically such a separation between the US and yeah. the UK. But it is no longer quite so much of a separation.
I don't know. I think that there's a kind of... lack of symmetry between the systems. You know, what I was struck by is that bringing to bear the information that I had about the effects of plutonium and americium and all the rest of it, there should be health consequences, you know? And then I think that you can't have access to health statistics from the National Health Service. They're treated as government secrets. You know, you have a very, very broadly generalized set of laws against, what's the word I want, unapproved propagation of corporate or government information, which is very different from us, you know, although God knows there's always somebody in court fighting about it, but in principle it's very different. But you can't really see the consequences of something like Sellafield if you don't see the health consequences, which you can't see. And of course, it's considered, you know, the National Health Service and everything that pertains to it is considered part of the welfare state. But then you have to ask, is that welfare that's being served there, you know? Perhaps it's just done out of habit, but I think taking a step back would be a very interesting thing to do. It doesn't seem to me to be functioning in the interest of public health.
And this is not something that's locked in the past, because in this collection you say... that both left and right have ignored the environment, the rights of poor people, and the rights of voters.
Exactly, exactly. We've gone into some, I think again, you know, this is just, but I think this tendency to overgeneralize, you know, we call ourselves the West, and that should mean that we just naturally, without even thinking about it, do, you know, West-type things, you know. And I think we've deluded ourselves. We've deluded ourselves to a degree that is... dangerous. In our last famous election in America, a lot of people didn't show up to vote. A lot of those same people would repent in sackcloth and ashes, but they felt that they were safe, that things would function as they assume they do conventionally, you know. Surprise, surprise. I hope we are learning a lot of very valuable things about our polity and its basis and its, you know, how it can be made secure.
The most recent essay, I think, is April 2017. So we're talking quite soon after the election. How have things moved on since this went to press, effectively, since these lectures were given? Do you feel that things have got worse? Have your worst fears been realized?
No. I mean, not for lack of effort, but he has not yet realized my worst fears. It is just a very interesting time in that country. You have this huge democracy, in effect, you know, that has functioned for a very long time on a sort of The word constitutional is sort of the magic word that can calm fears and you know, ensure equity and so on. And then the Constitution played a terrible trick on us, and we got a president who lost the popular vote decisively and won the Electoral College, which is just a quirk of the constitutional order. So how to get rid of him is basically the question, you know, and how to get rid of him with a minimum of destructive precedent built into the dealing with that problem, because the country runs very strongly on precedent and has a tendency, it never even realized before, I think, to be rather, you know, almost religiously serious about, you know, what would Jefferson do under these circumstances, you know? And now we have this raging, you know, creature in the White House, and he has no interest and no conception of things like that, the kind of, this is not conventional, you know, American presidents do not interfere in these situations and so on. And there he is, right in the middle of everything. But we can't allow him to effectively, to finally destroy what have been the surprisingly fragile pillars of our society. So people are trying to work around that, I think. I think there are a lot of very good people trying to figure out how to solve this problem with the minimum of damage.
The closing essay is called Slander, and you don't write personally very much, but it's quite a rarity in that you talk about your mother as part of a Republican consciousness, and in the context of untruth as something that is slanderous.
Mm-hmm. Well, intentional untruth is slanderous.
Yes.
And my mother, you know, in her long twilight, was introduced to the world of dysfunctional thinking, which, you know, all these narratives about subversion and plotting and so on that really cost her a great deal emotionally, a lot of anxiety and hostility and all sorts of things, that's the industry. It's the anxiety, hostility industry. And I have heard many stories, actually, from people with older relatives talking about how frightened they are because they've been listening to this stuff. And I wrote that essay, and then I sent it to my brother, and I said, should I publish this? And he said, no. And I did. And he sort of retracted the no, you know. But he and I were... I mean, she was his mother, too. I didn't want to make him feel bad, but it's an instance that I experienced very closely and watched for a long time, this fear.
But it's also about your compulsion to be a witness and to report truthfully what you see.
That certainly is. I mean, I always thought true was a kind of abiding standard, you know. Then you find out that it's, you know, more precious than gold and rubies and any other comparison you would want to make, you begin to realize that it can be a failing resource. And of course, I was speaking there to a church in the South. Whenever people of religious conservative leaning invite me to speak, I speak, and I tell them what I think. And what I was doing, to a very large extent, was pointing out to them how potent the word slander is in the Bible, and, you know, making the larger point that it's extremely dangerous, as they would measure these things, to be propagating destructive, pernicious statements about other things and other countries and other types and so on, that's a sin.
Now, I know that lots of people are going to want to move on to your fiction, because this is a life in writing. Okay. But I want to go via a couple of concepts that you introduced me to through this collection and also through The Givenness of Things. And so, starting off with The Givenness of Sins, the concept of given, the given, which just struck me, having read about it, I suddenly think I understand your novels in a slightly different way. Uh-huh. So will you explain what this is?
Well, it's what we experience as a coherent reality is actually put together rather arbitrarily of parts that have not any necessary relationship to one another. You know, when I talk about culture, one of the things I'm talking about is that the mentality that is acculturated in a certain way gathers in its mind a completed image of reality, you know? And that's a kind of lowercase version of the fact that everything is given. That, for example, if you know anything about existence at the atomic level, you know that this is a cloud of atoms. But it happens to be true that we exist at a certain scale that makes something we can put a glass on out of a cloud of atoms, the glass being another cloud of atoms, of course. That there's a sort of arbitrariness in the fact that we have what seems to us a complete and workable reality when we know, in fact, that it is selective and arbitrary, accidental perhaps almost. So I think that what I'm trying to say is that the world is not a solid little bean floating around in the universe. It is something that functions at many, many levels of reality, none of them completely descriptive of the reality altogether. That's kind of what I'm talking about.
So the next word, the next concept, this comes from this one, is entelechy.
Good old entelechy.
Entelechy, good old entelechy. How many people here have heard the word entelechy before and know what it means? Oh, nobody, thank goodness. I'm not in the minority. And again, it's a sort of, I've never heard it, but when you explain it, I just think, yeah, of course. Explain it.
I wish I'd read my explanation more recently. Well, you know, entelechy, it's a way of thinking as if things contain, you know, from the beginning they contain their ending, you know. It's a sort of, I suppose I would say, if at the highest level of generalization, I think of it as a way of describing the fact that nature of reality is kind of self-organizing, you know. I was thinking, this is embarrassing, I'm going to never tell anybody I said this, but I woke up the other morning thinking there was something wrong with the second law of thermodynamics. I don't know, things like this happen to me when I'm sleeping and I think, what is that about, you know? But the model of decay, the way that people, you know, the sort of decay of order that occurs spontaneously according to that law, I think decay is the wrong concept. It's actually reorganization, you know? I mean, if you were using, like, the way that atoms relate to each other, the way isotopes relate to each other, you know, there's not decay involved, there's reorganization. But anyway, which implies to me that reality is self-organizing. I mean, it seems perfectly obvious in a way, a seed will only become what is implicit in that seed to become. You know, its end is in its beginning, you know. You have to think about time in a different way, as non-sequential, as being something that is much more a matrix than a chronology as we normally think of it, you know. So that's what I mean by entelechy. It means something that has its end in its beginning. I've been writing about Genesis, you know, and one of the things that I was writing about was where it says that God has given us dominion over the earth and set all things under our feet and so on. I thought, with a certain amount of horror, that's absolutely true, you know, because here we are talking very seriously about trying to colonize Mars just for lack of better alternatives, you know. We really have created a problem, a situation where the sea could be vulnerable to us, the atmosphere could be vulnerable to us. It's not easy. You can't say, you know, this is hard to imagine. It's hard to imagine that it will not happen at this point. You think, dear God, he put the earth under our feet, you know. And that, you know, and so that, if it were true, if it bore out, it would be a classic instance of entelechy, because here we are at the beginning of Genesis, all this passing through the arc of history and arriving at the point where we think Genesis said something very true. But anyway, I don't know. I just toy, there are ideas I toy with. Self-organization, critical sort of effort to get beyond habitual assumptions about time.
It's funny because I was spent the whole weekend reading this collection and indeed revisiting the novels, and I had one of those night experiences, and I woke up and I thought, oh, the body is a metaphor. Because if you look at it from the point of view of all the microbes in it, it's a landscape.
Exactly. Why do we think we're one thing? That's spectacular in itself.
But this is because of what you made me think, because you sort of fire on all cylinders all the time. Is it exhausting being you?
Well, you know, I take naps.
And then the sort of final thing, it strikes me, one of the absolutely central debates in this collection is about beauty. And you have a very unusual idea of beauty. Well, for me.
Yes. Well, you know, I've thought about it a lot because, frankly, you know, I'm practicing art. You know, you want to know when you've done something that could be called beautiful and why and, you know, how'd that happen, you know. Knowing that you are forbidden to use any conventional approach to the problem of beauty because then it dies. And then it occurred to me because, I mean, beauty is continuously redefining itself. You know, it has different... It's a different standard in every culture. I use that word all the time, but you know, our cultures are extraordinarily complete realities that are extraordinarily different from one another, which is just fascinating. But cultures, one of the most impressive things that cultures do is organize themselves around very great displays of what they consider to be beautiful, which is usually their religious art. I think, you know, there's this, it's part of empiricity in a way, I suppose, the sort of capacity for things to go on before, you know, like we go through eras when standards of beauty change continuously, or you move through set, you know, levels of culture where standards of beauty are different from one another, you know? And it's as if there is something moving in a sort of a collective consciousness that can say to you, no, you can't do that, that's done, that's weary. That's not beautiful, you know, even if it was beautiful 200 years ago, you know. And I don't know how quite to describe this, but there's something live about it. It's not a hierarchical thing. It's something that, you know, where you look too much in one direction and it shows up over here, you know. I don't know.
Beauty disciplines, you say.
Beauty disciplines.
Beauty
yes.
disciplines. Which
beauty
is quite
says no a great deal of the time.
And you have this line, beauty recommends the best word in the best place. It can push at the borders of intelligibility and create new eloquence as it does so, which is a reflection of your writing process. I just thought it was really interesting. So it's like an idea of beauty is pushing you towards something bigger.
Mm-hmm. You know, I read these old lovely old Puritans like Jonathan Edwards and so on, and for him, the signature of the divine is the beautiful. And the signature of the attentive mind is the perception of the beautiful, you know? And in that sense, I mean, this, in the course of being very, very scrupulous about how you see, you know? And so the part of this conversation between the divine and the human that he thinks of continuously, a signature of it, sort of combustion of it, is the recognition of the beautiful, which occurs with that level of unpredictability. Almost like a gentle or a humorous conversation or a rigorous conversation. That's all very theological for him, that, you know, a divine light is really not light, it's something more beautiful than light that you can imagine because there is light, you know, and so on. But for him, the idea of the divine and the beautiful, in the high sense of the word, of course, these are simultaneous, and I find that very... Dare I say beautiful?
So you have these huge concepts floating around, and yet it's then in your fiction you focus it down on one little teeny community, one tiny group of people. Why? What is it that brings you back again and again to Gilead?
Well, I could only write about people that I can see at close range. I only write about people I love. If I don't love my character, I feel I'm failing him, and I have to basically cross him out. This doesn't happen often because I already know I can't go there, you know. I have no villains. But I think that the most inward life is probably the most beautiful thing, the thing that actually occurs at a scale that is appropriate to the universe. I mean, here we are, you know, I always tell my audiences, my students, I always say, the human brain is the most complex object known to exist in the universe, which seems rather arbitrary to me because the whole nervous system throughout the whole body is attached to the brain. So it's a kind of, you could say something even more extravagant about the whole device. But in any case, everybody has one, you know? And we are taught in a way to undervalue our inwardness, you know, what we dream and what we think and what we wonder about and so on. And only a few people have the opportunity to try to externalize their thinking. So we have to assume that a very great many masterpieces of human thought are simply passing through the world, not even knowing, never dreaming, you know. So I move close to characters who think a lot, not because they're exceptional in that, but because they're universal in that.
That was Marilyn Robinson speaking with Claire Armistead at a Guardian live event in London. What Are We Doing Here? Is published by Virago in the UK and FSG in the US. You can find out more about Guardian live events at theguardian.com/membership. Next week on the Books Podcast, we welcome the three debut novelists on the shortlist for this year's Desmond Elliott Prize, one of the leading markers of the brightest, freshest talent in fiction. Meanwhile, you can subscribe and review us on all your favourite podcatchers and join the discussion on Twitter by leaving a comment on the podcast page or emailing us on bookspodcast@theguardian.com. For now, for me, Richard Lee, and our producer, Susanna Tresillian, goodbye and thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.